Good morning. It's the 18th of November, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader and Flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you these headlines from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. U.S. will sell F-35 jet fighters to Saudi Arabia, Trump says. Market sell-off deepens as tech slumps. And Wall Street supercharges AI spending. Starting with that first article by Michael R. Gordon and Alexander Ward, U.S. will sell F-35 jet fighters to Saudi Arabia, Trump says. President Trump said Monday he'd sell stealthy F-35 jet fighters to Saudi Arabia, announcing his decision the day before he meets at the White House with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. "We'll be doing that. We'll be selling F-35s," Trump told reporters without providing any specifics. Trump's willingness to sell the advanced fighters is a clear signal that the Crown Prince has been fully rehabilitated in the eyes of the White House, despite the kingdom's role in the 2018 murder of journalist Khamil Khashoggi. But the looming deal has spurred concerns that an unconditional sale of the cutting-edge U.S. weapon system could erode Israel's military advantage in the region and reduce Washington's leverage to encourage Saudi Arabia and Israel to normalize relations, a step that diplomats in the region say isn't imminent. Having these things end up in the Saudi Air Force several years hence without normalization would be a misuse of American leverage, said John Hanna of the Jewish Institute for National Security of America, who served as an advisor to then-Vice President Dick Cheney. The Israeli Air Force is equipped with the F-35, which it's used to strike targets in Iran and elsewhere in the Middle East. Americans can expect more good deals for our country, spanning technology, manufacturing, critical minerals, defense, and more, said White House spokeswoman Anna Kelly of the Saudi leader's White House visit. Trump didn't address whether the eventual delivery of F-35s might be linked to an agreement between Saudi Arabia and Israel on establishing diplomatic ties, a long-standing U.S. goal. An F-35 deal is just one goal of the Washington visit by Mohammed bin Salman. Saudi Arabia's de facto leader is also seeking access to advanced U.S. computer chips, help for a prospective civilian nuclear power industry, and a statement that the two nations' security interests are aligned. His visit will come with all the trappings of a formal state visit, the culmination of a years-long effort to repair his image and relations with the White House. That effort began under the Biden administration and has accelerated under Trump, whose goal is to cement lucrative deals for U.S. companies, persuade Riyadh to eventually normalize relations with Israel and make Saudi Arabia a more central partner in the Middle East. The Crown Prince's visit will feature a formal White House dinner and will be followed on Wednesday by a U.S.-Saudi investment summit at the Kennedy Center, which could further Riyadh's goal of strengthening ties with the American businesses that will outlast a change in U.S. administrations. The Saudi leader cares the most about access to artificial intelligence, said Michael Ratney, who served as the U.S. ambassador in Riyadh from 2023 to 2025. He wants an agreement on reliable and predictable exports of the most advanced chips that would fuel their data centers in Saudi Arabia, Ratney said. The visit has spurred criticism from human rights activists who've alleged that Mohammed bin Salman's efforts to cast himself as a regional partner masks a heavy-handed intolerance of dissent at home. Saudi Arabia's crown prince is trying to rebrand himself as a global statesman, but the reality at home is mass repression, record numbers of executions, and zero tolerance for dissent, Sarah Yeager, the Washington director of Human Rights Watch, said in a statement. U.S. officials should be pressing for change, not posing for photos. For all of the expectations, some of the agreements will fall short of the accords that were under discussion a few years ago. An agreement on the U.S.-Saudi security partnership that Trump and Mohammed bin Salman are expected to issue won't take the form of a treaty, which would require ratification by the Senate. American and Saudi officials worked on a treaty during the Biden administration that would have committed the U.S. to defend the kingdom, strengthening decades-old defense ties. The initiative was part of a push to encourage the normalization of relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel. Hamas's October 7, 2023 attack on Israel and the resulting war in Gaza has complicated that normalization effort, with Saudi Arabia insisting it wouldn't join other Arab countries that have recognized Israel under the so-called Abraham Accords until there's a clear pathway toward a Palestinian state. On Monday evening, the United Nations Security Council passed Trump's plan for Gaza, providing a legal mandate for the enclave's reconstruction and an international stabilization force to keep order. The measure, which mentions a possible pathway to a Palestinian state, was backed by Saudi Arabia. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia are also expected to announce talks on a civil nuclear cooperation agreement in which the U.S. would provide vital technology. Neither has said what such an agreement might entail, including whether Riyadh would be allowed to enrich uranium on its territory, or what arrangements might be put in place to ensure that nuclear technology couldn't be used for military purposes. To sell a major weapon system such as the F-35 to Saudi Arabia, the Trump administration would need to formally notify Congress, which could block such a sale if the Senate and House each pass a resolution of disapproval. Trump could veto such a measure, which the House and Senate would need two-thirds to vote to override. Congress has never successfully blocked a proposed arms sale through such a procedure, according to the Congressional Research Service. Bradley Bowman, senior director at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a Washington-based institute focused on national security, said that lawmakers should press the Trump administration on what assurances it has received from Saudi Arabia that sensitive F-35 technology wouldn't be obtained by China, which is Riyadh's largest trading partner and has helped the kingdom develop ballistic missiles. You can't give Saudi Arabia the U.S.'s most advanced fighter and have it not affect Israel's qualitative military edge, which law requires Washington to maintain, Bowman said. The administration owes Congress answers on what additional steps it plans to take to maintain Israel's relative edge. A potential sale of F-35s to the United Arab Emirates was stymied because of U.S. concerns about expanding ties between Beijing and Abu Dhabi. And that's U.S. will sell F-35 jet fighters to Saudi Arabia, Trump says. Our next article, market sell-off deepens as tech slumps. Investors sell assets ahead of key AI test while Dow logs worst stretch in months. This is by David Uberti. An intensifying sell-off across financial markets Monday ensnared everything from gold to crypto to high-flying tech stocks, dragging the Dow Jones Industrial Average to its worst three-day stretch since President Trump's tariff turmoil in April. Investors in recent days have dumped assets in the lead-up to key tests for whether the artificial intelligence boom and economic growth that powered stocks to successive records in 2025 will continue into the new year. NVIDIA sat on Wednesday to report earnings in the latest snapshot for the chip demand. September jobs data, delayed during the government shutdown, is due out Thursday. Markets have been choppy this month after big tech companies projected massive capital expenditures that are increasingly reliant on issuing huge piles of debt. Traders' trepidation has sent Wall Street's so-called fear gauge, the CBOE Volatility Index, or VIX, to some of its highest levels since April's tariff announcements. Monday's retreat, which came as Amazon is set to issue $15 billion in bonds, provided fresh evidence that Wall Street is peeking closer under the hood of the expensive and sometimes circular deals underpinning one of the largest infrastructure buildouts in U.S. history. There should be more winners than not, said Osman Ali, global co-head of Goldman Sachs Asset Management's Quantitative Investment Strategies. But at the same time, it's very clear there are going to be companies that cannot compete in this new world. The tech-heavy NASDAQ on Monday dropped 0.8%, while the S&P 500 slid 0.9%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average retreated 1.2%, or 557 points. The sell-off continued in Asia. Early Tuesday, Japan's Nikkei 225 was down 1.8% and fell below the 50,000 level at the midday break. Warren Buffett's latest bet on a big tech firm wasn't enough to juice investors' optimism for other AI names. Berkshire Hathaway's multi-billion dollar purchase of Alphabet stock disclosed Friday sent the Google parent 3.1% higher Monday. Apple shares sank 1.8% after the Omaha, Nebraska firm trimmed its stake. At the same time, Nvidia, Meta, and Amazon all retreated. So did Advanced Micro Devices, Super Micro Computer, and Dell Technologies, a big supplier of AI servers. Oracle and CoreWeave extended their weeks-long tumble. Declines helped the S&P and NASDAQ composite on Monday to step past a line they hadn't crossed in 138 straight trading days, and not in the direction many investors hoped. For the first time since tariff confusion began to subside in May, the indexes dipped below their 50-day moving averages. Technical stock analysts often consider the benchmarks move above or below those averages as signals for the market's path forward. The broad index's turn lower ended its longest streak above that line, that trend line, since just before stocks topped out in 2007, the year before the global financial crisis triggered a brutal recession. While investors pared back some of their AI trades, crypto markets have been thrashed. The price of Bitcoin slid to $91,859.13 by 4 p.m. Monday, according to CoinDesk. Coinbase shares skidded 7.1%. Gold, which some analysts said has been trading more like a speculative stock than a safe asset, also pulled back. Front month futures slipped to $4,068.30 a troy ounce. Wall Street grew more wary of unprofitable tech while flying blind on the state of the economy during the recently ended government shutdown. On Monday, investors began to analyze backdated federal data for broader snapshots of business conditions. Non-residential construction spending declined in August from a month earlier, the Commerce Department reported Monday, with builders pulling back from most types of projects. Data center development was among the few bright spots. Bank stocks and smaller companies more sensitive to borrowing costs on Monday also extended declines in the face of uncertainty around Federal Reserve interest rate policy. Traders have pared back their bets on a cut in December, but futures markets suggest a nearly two-thirds chance of at least one cut by January. The yield on the 10-year Treasuries Monday settled at 4.132%, down from 4.147%. Friday. In a talk at the Kansas City Fed Monday, Fed Vice Chair Philip Jefferson said the risk of stubborn inflation and weaker employment conditions underscores the need to proceed slowly with rate cuts. His comments did little beyond that to build the case for either a cut or pause at the Fed's December meeting. And that's market sell-off deepens as tech slumps. Our next article, Wall Street supercharges AI spending. Blue Owl and others have raised trillions to invest, ignoring flashing warning signs. This is by Matt Wirtz and Peter Rudiger. Long ago, Blue Owl Capital was an upstart investment firm that lent money to mid-sized U.S. companies such as Sara Lee Frozen Bakery. These days, the firm is financing massive data centers costing tens of billions of dollars for the likes of Meta and Oracle, a sign of just how quickly Wall Street has become the enabler of America's artificial intelligence boom. Fund managers such as Blue Owl amassed trillions of dollars of investing firepower and have been hunting for big deals where they can put that money to work. They found slim pickings for years until a perfect match appeared in AI, which has provided a much bigger target than anything in history due to the vast sums tech companies need to ramp up computing power. We're talking about numbers that are so large, even in these low cases, said Blue Owl co-founder Mark Lipschultz. Does it even matter if you keep counting after you get to $1 trillion of capital expenditure in the next couple of years? Last week's sell-off in tech-related stocks and bonds marked some of the most serious warning signs that the frenzy could be overdone. But any worries on Wall Street about a possible investment bubble have been largely trumped by the fear of being left behind. Lipschultz and co-founder Doug Ostrover jumped into the fray at a posh retreat in California's Ojai Valley for dozens of tech VIPs and celebrities in the spring of 2024. Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg and Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella were there. The Blue Owl duo, Wall Street superstars who built the firm into a $295 billion fund manager in 10 years by perfectly timing a surge in private lending, looked like just two money men in sneakers and fleece vests, but the billionaires, co-owners of a professional hockey team who've talked of skating where the puck is going, seized the opportunity to get in on the AI boom. The Blue Owl executives cut a deal to acquire IPI Partners, an investment firm that owned and operated big data centers for Amazon and Microsoft. Blue Owl had already had close ties with the organizer of the retreat, Iconic Capital, which manages the personal fortunes of Silicon Valley elite, including Zuckerberg, and was a part owner of IPI. The purchase gave Blue Owl a seat at the table to bid on mega AI financings. Not long after, it got picked to arrange a $14 billion package for an Oracle and OpenAI data center in Abilene, Texas. Then, last month, Blue Owl raised about $30 billion to build an AI data center for Meta in Louisiana, putting in $3 billion of its clients' money and borrowing the rest. The deal included a provision considered extraordinary on Wall Street, giving Blue Owl's equity investment a debt-like guarantee in case the partnership falls apart, showing the new financial wizardry bankers are conjuring to meet AI's ravenous financial demand. Spreading the risk. Silicon Valley's biggest players are flush with cash and were able to fund much of the initial AI build-out from their own coffers. As the dollar figures climb ever higher, they're turning to debt and private equity, spreading the risks and potential rewards more broadly across the economy. Some of the financing is coming from plain vanilla corporate bond sales, but financiers are making far bigger fees off giant private deals. Virtually every Wall Street player is angling to get a piece of the action, from banks such as J.P. Morgan Chase and Morgan Stanley, to traditional asset managers such as BlackRock. Investor appetite for data center debt is so strong that some money managers have booked billion-dollar gains in a matter of days, even before construction of facilities they are financing is complete. Still, the longer-term performance is hardly assured. Big tech companies are expected to spend nearly $3 trillion on AI through 2028, but only generate enough cash to cover half that tab, according to analysts at Morgan Stanley. Big names in the financial world, such as Goldman Sachs CEO David Solomon, are warning about AI-fueled froth in the markets and in capital spending. At the same time, the fear of missing out is real. Days after Solomon voiced his concerns to analysts, Goldman formed a new team in its banking and markets group focused on AI infrastructure financing. What we do know for certain is that the big tech companies that want the world to spend trillions have huge financial incentives to be believers. In case you haven't noticed, Wall Street's also being paid a lot to promote the story. Greenlight Capital, the hedge fund firm run by David Einhorn, wrote in an October letter to investors. There have been some wobbles of late. Stock prices normally go up when a company reports record revenue, but after Meta did just that on October 29th, its shares plummeted 11% instead. The reason? Zuckerberg disclosed he will aggressively increase capital spending on AI, drawing questions from analysts about how the company plans to actually make money off the new technology. If the AR market blows up, the blast radius would be wide, hitting Wall Street firms, pensions, mutual and exchange-traded funds, and individual investors because of how debt is often sliced and resold. The bonds financing Meta's Hyperion data center in Louisiana can be found in Main Street funds offered by BlackRock, Invesco, Janus Henderson, and PIMCO. Investors in Blue Owl's latest $7 billion digital infrastructure fund include the state pension plans of Pennsylvania and New York. Funds that invest in AI deals say they carry little risk because tech companies with deep pockets have ironclad leases that will generate the money to pay investors back. Microsoft has a higher credit rating than the U.S. government, and it told investors it would double its total data center footprint in the next 2 years. Tech executives see more risk in underbuilding than overbuilding. I thought we were going to catch up. We are not. Demand is increasing, Microsoft Finance Chief Amy Hood said. But some tech companies are weaker financially than others. Oracle, which is angling to be the go-to computing provider for labs like OpenAI, is by far the most indebted tech giant in the mix. It needs to borrow billions more for its spending spree, prompting Moody's Ratings and S&P Global Ratings to edge closer to reclassifying Oracle's bonds as junk debt. The company share price has fallen in recent weeks. There's also the risk that the chips tech firms are borrowing to buy could be obsolete in a few years. Apart from its data center investments, Blue Owl is lending money to an effort to buy NVIDIA chips that will be leased by Elon Musk's XAI. The last time Wall Street went all in was the fracking boom, then bust, over a decade ago. Financiers are now marshaling even larger sums. The combined borrowing of every oil and gas company in the world from 2012 to 2015 was about $1 trillion, according to data from Dealogic. A handful of AI tech giants will borrow roughly $1.2 trillion from 2025 to 2028, according to the Morgan Stanley estimates. As it happens, Blue Owl's data center project in Abilene is on the edge of the West Texas oil patch that was the epicenter of the fracking boom. In late September, the firm invited executives from about 40 pensions, endowments, and other institutions that invest in its funds to see the data center that will eventually rise from the Texas prairie. The investors piled into five-person buggies to get a tour of the campus, which has a 5,000-car parking lot just for its construction workers. The crews in Abilene are assembling eight data center buildings spanning around 4 million square feet. The campus will ultimately draw up to 1.2 gigawatts of power, or enough juice for about 1 million homes. Lining the insides will be around 500,000 NVIDIA chips stuffed into dense racks requiring constant cooling. Financially, the venture depends heavily on Oracle, which has leased it for 15 years. Oracle, in turn, will rely on a single customer, Sam Altman's OpenAI, for some $300 billion in long-term revenue. Meanwhile, Oracle is buying chips from NVIDIA, which has committed $100 billion to OpenAI, the sort of circularity that raises questions about whether AI revenue is being recycled. The roughly $10 billion in loans taken out to build the Abilene project come due in 5 years and will be difficult to refinance if the Oracle-OpenAI partnership underperforms. Blue Owl offsets the higher risk of contracting with Oracle by charging higher rent than companies like Meta pay, a person familiar with the matter said. In Meta's Hyperion project, Blue Owl put in $3 billion from its private equity funds and $27 billion borrowed from bond investors at a 6.58% interest rate. The firm expects to make returns of about 13% annually off Meta lease payments, people familiar with the matter said. The new business could boost Blue Owl stock, which has declined 35% this year as concerns about private credit defaults mounted. Banks are getting in on the action. About a year and a half ago, bankers at J.P. Morgan got a call from a longtime client with what sounded like a crazy hypothetical. How would you finance a project to build a campus of AI data centers that would draw 1 gigawatt of power? The bankers told their client, a developer and landlord called Vantage Data Centers, that it would never need that much capacity, but they walked through how one could raise the money. Earlier this year, Vantage called J.P. Morgan to say it wanted to pull the trigger with one tweak. Instead of building a single 1 gigawatt data center, it wanted to build two of them. Not long after, J.P. Morgan and a group of other banks agreed to lend $38 billion for a data center in Texas's Shackelford County and another one outside Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Lucrative week. The 5-year debt package, named Jacquard, was so jumbo-sized that more than 30 other banks, from global giants such as J.P. Morgan to regional players such as U.S. Bancorp, were tapped to sell portions to investors. They are pitching insurers, corporate debt funds, and almost every type of bond buyer. Morgan Stanley began pitching top tech companies years ago. The effort delivered in October when the bank arranged deals worth about $75 billion in 1 week, including the debt from Meta's Hyperion, the $20 billion sale of Align Data Centers, and a $3.2 billion junk bond. When Blue Owl went looking to borrow the money it needed for the Meta project, the firm and Morgan Stanley settled on PIMCO, an asset manager known for its expertise in fixed income. PIMCO committed to buying $18 billion of the bonds but demanded a high interest rate and guarantees in exchange. Other funds asked to participate but were shut out. That created pent-up demand, and when the bonds began trading in October, prices jumped by about 10%, giving PIMCO $2 billion of paper profits. Prices have slipped slightly, trimming the gains to $1.1 billion. Bond funds are clamoring for the deal because it delivers high returns or yields, typical of junk bonds, but with protections associated with investment-grade credit ratings. Ratings firms scored the bond so highly because Meta pledged that bondholders and Blue Owl will get all their money back, even if it stops leasing the data center. And that's Wall Street supercharges AI spending. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either as it streams or at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website, and that's at sunsounds.org. You can also download the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, and that's available for your iPhone or iPad from the Apple App Store, or for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store. And you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show. Well, let's turn now to the business and finance section of the Wall Street Journal, where we have these headlines. Sinclair presses Scripps for deal. J&J boosts cancer lineup via $3 billion purchase. And Baby Shark Maker only got small bite of YouTube's riches. That first headline, Sinclair presses Scripps for deal. Media company takes 8% stake in Target after months of merger talks. This is by Lauren Thomas and Joe Flint. Sinclair said Monday it built a roughly 8% stake in EW Scripps and is vying to acquire the TV broadcaster. The companies held constructive talks about a potential deal in recent months, but have yet to strike an agreement, Sinclair said. Sinclair's stake was disclosed in a regulatory filing, confirming an earlier report by the Wall Street Journal. Sinclair bought up the stake to add pressure on Scripps to strike a deal. It says it believes scale at both the national and local levels is increasingly necessary in the broadcast TV industry to compete against other media and tech companies. Scripps, with a total market value of around $270 million, has over 60 local TV stations spanning more than 40 markets. It has struggled relative to its peers over the long term, though its share price climbed almost 40% so far this year through Friday, in part as investors cheered progress on its sports strategy. Over the summer, for example, Scripps signed a multi-year media rights agreement to carry Friday night Women's National Basketball Association matchups on its ION network. Scripps stock climbed 40% Monday on news of Sinclair's stake in the takeover talks. Sinclair's stock rose 4.9%. Sinclair has a market value of about $1.1 billion and is one of the country's largest owners of local TV stations, with 178 stations affiliated with major broadcasters such as ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, and the CW across over 80 markets. Sinclair said in August its board signed off on a strategic review of its broadcast business, which included examining potential sales and acquisitions. Soon after, Sinclair proposed merging its broadcast TV business with Tegna, the Wall Street Journal reported, but Tegna ended up agreeing to sell to Nexstar in a $6.2 billion deal. The Justice Department has since sought more information on the deal, and a Sinclair-Scripps tie-up could face similar scrutiny. Industry watchers say the agreement between Nexstar and Tegna kicked off further consolidation among other operators. Sinclair is also among broadcasters that have pushed the Federal Communications Commission to relax rules that prohibit a broadcaster from owning TV stations that reach more than 39% of the nation's TV households. FCC Chairman Brendan Carr has been public about his belief that restrictions should be loosened, and many expect that ownership cap to be removed in 2026. Sinclair estimates Scripps investors could have the value of their shares triple over time if the two combined. The company also believes a deal could close within 9 to 12 months, according to Monday's filing. Sinclair also said it structured its takeover proposal to require no external financing, with the goal of bringing down Scripps' debt load. Sinclair was one of two station groups that briefly pulled Jimmy Kimmel's late-night show during the recent controversy over the host's remarks about the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. President Trump has defended the company in the past. And that's Sinclair presses Scripps for deal. Our next article by Colin Kelleher. J&J boosts cancer lineup via $3 billion purchase. Johnson & Johnson has agreed to buy clinical-stage biotechnology company Halda Therapeutics for $3.05 billion in cash in a deal that bolsters the healthcare giant's oncology pipeline. J&J on Monday said the deal, slated to close within the next few months, adds Halda's proprietary platform to develop oral, targeted therapies for multiple types of solid tumors, including prostate cancer. The New Brunswick, New Jersey company said Halda's lead candidate, HLD-0915, is a once-daily therapy for prostate cancer that has the potential to transform patient outcomes with a novel, precision, cancer cell-killing approach that can overcome mechanisms of resistance to treatment. J&J said it expects the Halda acquisition will reduce its 2026 adjusted per-share earnings by about 15 cents due to short-term financing and a charge related to equity awards for Halda employees. Johnson & Johnson stock rose 1.9% Monday. And that's J&J boosts cancer lineup via $3 billion purchase. Our next item, Baby Shark Maker only got small bite of YouTube's riches. This is by Jiyoung Song and Elena Pipe. Soul. Baby Shark Dance, the aggravatingly addictive children's tune, is YouTube's most watched video ever. It has been played on average more than 4.7 million times a day since its 2016 upload. The Doot 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 nursery rhyme has amassed 16.4 billion views, roughly equivalent to Taylor Swift's 10 most popular YouTube videos combined. But all that viral power hasn't translated into a mega fortune for Pinkfong, the South Korean company behind the two-minute jingle about a family of sharks. Last year, the company generated the equivalent of about $67 million in revenue, including earnings from YouTube. The quandary underscores how certain restrictions placed on online children's content cap the ability to monetize all that attention. Pinkfong was listed on South Korea's KOSDAQ market on Tuesday. Baby Shark, which transformed a camp sing-along into a viral hit, made its debut nearly a decade ago. By 2020, it passed Luis Fonsi's song Despacito to become YouTube's most watched video. The gap keeps growing wider. The traffic flows in from around the world. The song is available in 25 different languages. The U.S. ranks as the biggest market for views, while Brazil has delivered the most likes. The Seoul-based companies first considered going public in 2019. Pinkfong thought it carried a higher valuation than investors did. The initial public offering plans didn't materialize. On Tuesday in Seoul, Pinkfong rose about 37% to roughly $36 a share in mid-morning trading. That moved the company's market value to the equivalent of roughly $504 million. One limit to monetizing through YouTube is strict rules for made-for-kids content. In 2020, YouTube, after settling a lawsuit the year before with the Federal Trade Commission over complying with the U.S.'s Children's Online Policy Protection Act, imposed stiffer restrictions on children's content. YouTube applied the policy globally, including barring personalized advertising and disabling comments and subscriber notifications that help drive engagement. That led to a severe drop in the profitability of many kid content creators. Without the tighter restrictions, Baby Shark could generate two or three times as much direct revenue for Pinkfong, according to an estimate by Boston University's Garrett Johnson, who's analyzed the 2019 settlement's effect on online children's content. Most of Pinkfong's revenue comes from content sales, which includes earnings from YouTube and other platforms such as concerts, versus smaller lines of business and licensing or merchandising. Operating profit hit roughly $13 million last year. Through the IPO, Pinkfong is set to generate nearly $50 million in funds when excluding costs, which will help it create new content. It wants to produce three new titles by 2028. And that's Baby Shark Maker, only got small bite of YouTube's riches. Our next article is by Jennifer Williams. Domino's puts hopes on rebranding. Domino's Pizza hopes its first rebrand in 13 years will help it sell more pizzas, wings, and cheesy bread as Americans pull back on eating out. The world's largest pizza chain last month revamped its look to feature brighter black and gold boxes, a new jingle, and a logo with a thicker font. The changes are rolling out now as other updates at the chain, such as its first stuffed crust pizza and a partnership with DoorDash, are boosting sales. We really haven't updated a lot, and I think a lot has evolved in the way consumers gravitate toward brands, said Chief Financial Officer Sandeep Reddy. We saw an opportunity. Restaurant chains are challenged as consumers eat out less. Cava and Chipotle Mexican Grill have cut their outlooks, pointing to weaker demand from certain customers. Meanwhile, Yum! Brands is evaluating strategic options for its struggling Pizza Hut business, including the sale of all or parts of the brand. Fast food traffic is down 2.4% this year compared with a 1.6% drop for restaurants overall, according to a market research firm, Black Box Intelligence. Domino's has been a bright spot. The company's total sales rose 6.2% from a year earlier in the 3 months ended September 7th. U.S. same-store sales grew 5.2% in the period. One factor was a deal added to the menu in August for a pizza with any toppings for $9.99. Reddy declined to share how much of Domino's sales stem from the deal, but it returned for a third run that ended last month because of its popularity among consumers and franchisees, he said. One advantage for Domino's is its scale. Selling an average of 4 million pizzas a day globally means costs for ingredients, packaging, and other items are more attractive, according to the CFO. Stuffed crust pizza, which Pizza Hut rolled out in 1995, also is providing a boost. Domino's added mozzarella-filled crust to its menu in March after decades of holding out. Diners are eating them up, according to Reddy. Reddy said the company's high expectations for the menu addition are being met. Now the cheese-filled crust option will see a box upgrade. It's been over a decade since the company last updated its brand, and the changes last month were over a year and a half in the making, Reddy said. Elements include a jingle performed by country star Shaboozy, and new boxes, black ones for more premium fare such as stuffed crust pies, and brighter red, white, and blue packaging for the rest. Recent brand updates have been met with backlash, prompting some companies to drop the revamp plans. Reddy isn't worried that the Domino's changes, which are expected to be fully rolled out in the coming months, will suffer the same fate. You do the correct research and you're very objective about what the feedback is telling you, he said. You don't get married to an idea. Reddy declined to disclose how much the company has spent on the rebrand. It wasn't a huge amount compared with the chain's annual U.S. marketing budget of around $500 million, he said. As brighter boxes make their way into Domino's stores, consumers are looking to spend less on eating out. Reddy flagged last month that sales across the restaurant industry started slowing down around October. Domino's should be well-positioned, analysts said. For one thing, carryout orders, which in the past have lagged behind deliveries, were up 8.7% in the latest three-month period. Domino's executives have said customers rarely switch between carryout and delivery. The overlap rate is somewhere in the mid-teens, which means the momentum is primarily driven by new customers, said Peter Sala, a restaurants and food distributors analyst at BTIG. Domino's is additionally reaching a broader consumer base for delivery now that it's on DoorDash as well as Uber. Pizza can also be a good option for cost-conscious diners, said Sally. You could walk into Domino's and get two large pies with one or two toppings on them and walk out for around $20, he said. Jennifer Williams writes for the Wall Street Journal's Pros CFO Journal, and this is her article, Domino's Puts Hopes on Rebranding. Next, we turn to Sotheby's turned a museum into an auction house for its fall sales. This article by Kelly Crow. Sotheby's will need to tear down five walls in its biggest gallery the night before its inaugural sale on Tuesday just to make enough room for bidders to sit. The auction house has moved into Marcel Breuer's 1966 modernist landmark that looks like an inverted ziggurat and once famously housed the Whitney Museum of American Art. The auction house paid $100 million a year ago for the modernist museum space, then enlisted Swiss architectural firm Herzog and de Meuron in collaboration with New York-based PBDW architects to renovate it, including constructing a 13-foot-wide freight elevator at the back so the house can move more art in and out easily. The stakes are high for Sotheby's, which needs to make good on its splashy investment after a few tough years as the art market has tried to crawl out of a slump and the auction house has faced cash flow problems. Sotheby's has coped by making dramatic moves, including cutting a deal with an Abu Dhabi wealth fund for a nearly $1 billion infusion and moving its New York flagship from a nondescript building near Manhattan's East River to the Breuer on a chic Madison Avenue block near boutiques, galleries, and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Already there are signs the strategy is working. The house said the Breuer was a key draw for the estate of cosmetics executive Leonard Lauder, whose estimated $400 million collection will now be auctioned off in the same building where Lauder once served as the Whitney's chairman. So much about art is about presentation and framing, said Drew Watson, head of art services at Bank of America, which advises its collector clients on art buys. The Brewer is a work of art itself, so it elevates everything. Museums need galleries to tastefully display art, so do auction houses. But they also need a practical space to eventually auction it, an area called a sale room. Sotheby's chose the fourth floor gallery of the Brewer to serve as both a gallery and sale room. For the past couple of weeks, the space has been set up as a lavish gallery to preview some of its priciest offerings, including Lauder's estimated $150 million Gustav Klimt portrait of Elizabeth Lederer, and other works by Henri Matisse and Edvard Munch. But starting at 5 p.m. on Monday, the entire room will undergo a dramatic metamorphosis. Sotheby's will close its doors, remove the Klimt and other treasures, and send in a hive of workers with handheld drywall saws to break down at least five walls, according to Steve Wrightson, the house global head of real estate. The auctioneer's rostrum will be set up near the floor's famed Cyclopean window, and two huge flat screens will be mounted on a wall nearby so that bidders can also track the work's prices in several currencies at once. A scrim will cover the huge window itself so that no one outside can peer in to see who's bidding. Telephone banks will be set up on either side of the room for specialists to field phone bids. Just don't expect to waltz in and get a seat. 20 years ago, it was common to see up to 600 people cramming into seats with paddles to bid during Sotheby's high-profile sales. More recently, the crowd thinned to around 350 as more collectors started watching the sale over a live stream. The Brewer will only have seats for about 250 people. Next spring, it will add a mezzanine with a row of up to six skyboxes for VIPs, Sotheby's chief executive Charles Stewart said. Seats will be given to people they anticipate will bid, not merely watch. We want a room with a lot of heat, he said. A renovated space. The 90,000-square-foot Brewer, which is about a fifth the size of Sotheby's former outpost, will mainly serve as a glamorous front-of-the-house showroom for its art. In the lobby, the museum's coat check area now looks more like a retail shop with jewelry and vitrines designed to sit atop landmarked concrete benches. Wrightson said the house added 30% more gallery space to the Brewer's footprint by repurposing office space, library areas, and even a museum conservator's studio into additional galleries. All these changes are meant to be nearly invisible, according to Jacques Herzog, who, with Pierre de Meuron, oversaw the renovation of the Brewer. Herzog said they wanted to pay their respects to the Brewer's hard-edged design while also finding subtle ways to make the space more useful for Sotheby's, like that huge freight elevator, and inviting to the public. Herzog said he wanted to tackle a Brewer in part because he believes architects should look to revamp existing historic buildings and enliven what already exists instead of striving to only create from scratch. Sotheby's also festoons its galleries with more than 1,200 new spotlights that can shine on art depending on how pieces look best. David Galperin, who heads the Sotheby's Contemporary Art Department in New York, said, "Collectors want lighting to position their art in the most alluring ways for potential bidders. We want intimate moments and hero moments," he said, drawing visitors. When it was the Whitney, visitors paid up to $20 per person to see art at the Brewer. Now that it's an auction house, the public can walk in free and view a regularly revolving slate of offerings, from rare books to old master paintings to dinosaur skeletons, depending on the sale calendar. Stewart said the challenge for Sotheby's will be to schedule enough to see between its tentpole sales because he wants the public to be dazzled year-round. While next year's sale calendar is still being finalized, he said the auction house is mounting a December 13th through the 21st exhibition, Sotheby's Icons, Back to Madison, that will feature major pieces that have sold at Sotheby's over the decades. The auction house also decided that the space needed extra restrooms, so at least four additional ones are now tucked in throughout the building, including the mirrored rendition currently housing Maurizio Cattelan's estimated $10 million solid gold toilet, America, that Sotheby's is auctioning Tuesday night. It'll get an ordinary toilet afterward. Good thing, too, because over its opening weekend, at least 7,000 people visited Sotheby's at the Brewer. During its last major preview weekend in May at its old locale, the house said only 1,500 people stopped by. And that Sotheby's turned a museum into an auction house for its fall sales. We'll turn now to Heard on the Street, financial analysis and commentary from the Wall Street Journal. And we have this article, Why We Could Use a Good Long Bear Market. Stocks have experienced only brief downturns over the past 16 years, creating dangerous complacency. This article is by Spencer Jacob. How bad do you think it's going to be? When Michael Corleone asks Clemenza in The Godfather about the mob war he's about to start, he gets the sort of reassurance that comes with experience. These things gotta happen every 5 years or so, 10 years, helps to get rid of the bad blood. Been 10 years since the last one. There's no saying when the next major bear market will send Americans to the mattresses, maybe through the collapse of AI mania or possibly just a garden variety recession. There have been only minor scrapes in the past 16 years, and that's actually a problem. A downturn like 2007 through 2009, when U.S. stocks fell by more than half, can be both awful and therapeutic. It took 66 months for the S&P 500 to regain its previous high. Investors with a long-term perspective pounced on what, in hindsight, were solid, boring bargains near the bottom. The five brief downturns since then that met the unofficial definition of a bear market taught the opposite lesson. Momentarily terrifying, they encouraged investors to buy the dip, quickly and recklessly. The junkier the stocks, the better. Remember the summer of 2020 when Nikola, the fraudulent hydrogen truck company, became worth more than Ford Motor? Or when bankrupt Hertz's shares were touted on social media and soared? This year's Liberation Day swoon felt similar. It took just 4.3 months for the S&P 500 to reach a fresh high. The advance was led by the theme du jour, artificial intelligence, plus many unproven, unprofitable companies. Long bear markets accompanied by a recession discredit the last boom's wildest themes and its cheerleaders. They also remind us of what capital markets are for, matching mostly good businesses with patient savers' nest eggs. In the past century, there have been 26 bear markets, including some that barely met the definition, such as this year's swoon. The average time to reach the previous high when a bear market was accompanied by a recession was 81 months. It took just 21 without a recession. Over the past 16 years, downturns have lasted less than 8 months before the old high was released. The model for buying the dip was set in the summer of 1998 after Russia defaulted and hedge fund long-term capital management collapsed. The Federal Reserve stepped in and the effect was electric, sending stocks back to a new high by that November. The tech-heavy NASDAQ composite would go on to rally 255% over 17 months. In 1999 and 2000 combined, there were 631 technology initial public offerings, according to Jay Ritter, a University of Florida finance professor. Their average multiple of price to sales was nearly 50 when they began trading. Multiples of 2 to 6 are more typical. That rewarding bounce made the tech bubble wilder, as did the fact that few people in the market in the late 1990s had personally experienced a really nasty long downturn. Sort of like today. Hardly anyone younger than 40 now even had a 401k during the 2007-9 wipeout. Most Wall Street pros hadn't graduated from college yet. Bear markets are educational, but the tuition is a doozy. And that's why we could use a good long bear market. We have time for one more brief article. Novo Nordisk obesity drug prices fall. And this is by Nicholas G. Miller. Novo Nordisk slashed prices for its obesity drugs months before an agreement with the Trump administration mandating that it lower its GLP-1 prices takes effect. The Denmark-based company on Monday said it would offer the first two monthly doses of Wegovy and Ozempic for $199 a month to those who pay in cash between now and March 31 of next year. After those 2 months, patients will pay the new standard monthly cash price of $349, down from a previous price of $499. Earlier this month, Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly both agreed to cut prices for the weight loss drugs as part of the deals with the Trump administration. Those lower prices were set to begin next March, but Novo Nordisk said Monday its new lower prices would come in advance of that agreement taking effect. Once the dominant player in the GLP-1 market, Novo Nordisk has fallen behind Eli Lilly and has lost share to other providers, including Hims and Hers Health. And that's Novo Nordisk obesity drug prices fall. You've been listening to The Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to remind you, you can listen to The Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either as it streams or at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app for your iPad or iPhone from the Apple App Store or your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store. And you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show.